I would have to say, like, if you made me just, you know, if I had me at knife point today, I would say the Democrats are very competitive to flip the Senate right now.
Warning. The political trade features probabilities and perspectives about politicians, political parties, political outcomes, and political wagering. The political trade is rated NSFP, not safe for partisans.
The number one biggest game is when they gain no more fame. It's like a race at the top because they want to be boss. They don't care who they step on as long as they get along. Politicians in my eyes.
Welcome back to The Political Trade, the podcast for people with a passion for politics, probability, and profits. I'm Jeff Joseph, editorial director of Luckbox Magazine, hosting the podcast, where conservatives and liberals, Republicans and Democrats, partisans and wingnuts all converge to make money betting on politics by trading in the prediction markets at Predictit.org, the stock market for politics that trades 24/7. Joining us on the show today is Niskanen Center researcher, self-described election whisperer and data maven, Rachel Bitticoffer. From the moment we first saw Dr. Bitticoffer on the Real Time with Bill Maher show, we were hoping to have her on our show to share her wisdom with you. So up ahead, we'll be talking to Rachel about her latest report, Negative Partisanship and the 2020 Congressional Elections, discussing the latest political news, and looking to the prediction markets on Predictit.org for potential market mispricings. As always, I'm joined by Mike Reddy. Mike is the editor of Luckbox Magazine, a new prediction market trader, and the producer of The Political Trade. And Mike, I'm excited to have Rachel on. How about yourself?
Oh, absolutely. She pretty much nailed the midterm spot on. So I'm really excited to hear her takes on some of the markets today.
Yeah, I'd like to ask her about that at the outset, too, because it's the platform that really brought her a lot of visibility as to being so accurate on the 2018 congressional election. So I'd like to delve into that a little bit deeper and find out more about what differentiated her forecasts and how that evolved, and learn more about her methodology. One of the things I'm really excited about this show is when we announced in the last episode that Dr. Bitticoffer was going to be on, our listeners sent us a lot of emails saying, you know, we've heard her, we respect her work, we really want to hear her thoughts on the market. So what we're going to do a little bit different this time is spend a lot of time in our trade section. We're going to walk through a lot of trades and hear exactly what Rachel has to think about these specific markets and where the probabilities are pointing in her direction from her perspective. So hopefully she'll be ringing the bell quite a bit as we walk through these markets, and looking forward to bringing her on. So let's actually do that. Rachel, are you on with us?
I am. I'm excited to be here. It's going to be a great conversation.
Well, it's going to be an interesting conversation because I won't mind admitting just a moment ago in the last 10 minutes in our warm-up before the show, when Mike and I were speaking with you, it became evident that you're really not frequenting it by any means the political prediction markets. You're not a trader. So you've never placed a wager on these markets before. And even though you've been very visible as a result of your prowess and prediction, have done a number of shows and podcasts, and your reports really, you know, I know when you first released it, it almost crashed your website. But what you've never done is sit down and talk about the specific market opportunities and how your modeling and your forecasts relate to the opportunities that are available for prediction market traders. So we thought we would kind of shift our show over and spend the bulk of this looking at those markets. I think we have 15 markets to walk through in the second segment of this episode. So we're looking forward to it. And maybe we're going to end up tarnishing you a little bit, because I think you were surprised as to how the economics of prediction market trading worked.
Yeah, I am. I mean, it's surprisingly simplistic and obviously very lucrative. So I know I had a few followers through 2018 that would ask me about things, and then they came back to me very, very pleased after the election and told me that they had made money off of me, but I had no idea they had made that much money off of me. So no wonder they were pleased. And, you know, they could have sent some flowers or something. You know?
you would think, right? Well, so I think that's what makes this so genuine. You truly are new to the prediction markets, but not by any means new to the data analysis and the election markets. So let's jump into it. But to begin with, it is true that 2018's election and your forecast really set you apart amongst your peers. Can you just give us a little bit more background about what those forecasts were and what accounted for the different outcomes that you predicted as opposed to your peer group?
Yeah, it's so important just to remind everybody what makes my stuff different is the theory. you know, the modernization of election analysis that I'm bringing, which is driven by this sore need to get the election analysis world talking about political polarization and hyperpartisanship and how that is tangibly affecting elections and political behavior, voter behavior. I was actually just having a conversation before this conversation, recounting, you know, the timeline of how I built my theory and my model. And it reminded me so much of the frustration of 2015, 2016, and even 2017, watching TV, you know, reading stuff online on the election websites, and just seeing this major gap of not people not appreciating how much polarization was affecting things. So, you know, my research is really the forecasting stuff is the fruit on the tree, but the tree is this argument that voter behavior has been really impacted by polarization, that, you know, we aren't paying enough attention to the demographic composition of electorates and the differentials of turnout between one cycle or a next. Those demographics make a partisan composition. And ultimately, at the end of the day, with voters, partisanship has always been important, but now it's really super important because in the old days, you used to have liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats, and they might be inclined to vote for a Ronald Reagan if they were a Reagan Democrat, or, you know, maybe vote for a, you know, a Democrat if they were a Republican that was attractive to them. These days, that's just not the case. I mean, it's very little crossover voting. It's about 10% in any given election. It's very predictable. And the amount of independents that are truly independent is pretty small. Most are what we call leaners. So they lean towards one party or the other. And they vote predictably for that party that they lean. That small group of pure independents are also kind of predictable in their behavior. They tend to break against the party in power. I call them change voters. And so what we haven't been looking at is what I call the turnout swing. And that is not just amongst partisans, but also independents. So, you know, sometimes independents break in favor of Democrats. It's not necessarily because the same 100 people suddenly move left to right. It's because a different 100 people show up, or an additional 100 people show up. And so I'm really trying to bring that nuance to how we look at election outcomes, how we predict them, and get people to understand what moves voter behavior at that mass level. And once you do that, you notice that a lot of the things people are looking at, like polls, those are not signals. Those are nice indicators, but the signals are much bigger, more set in stone fundamentals that we can see far in advance.
And that clearly is the differentiator from in your modeling, is that you're more focused on the partisanship that is more predictive of a voter's outcome or how any individual is going to vote. So how do you quantify, tell us how you quantify that. How would you quantify partisanship?
Yeah, I mean, partisanship is easy to quantify in terms of, you know, you have self-identified partisanship. The way that my forecasting model actually works, it's very, very different. Even this prediction market, as explained to me, is producing these probabilities, or it's a function of probabilities. Certainly Nate Silver's model, which is the gold standard model for probabilistic forecasting, is a totally different version of what's happening. My model is not actually a probability model at all. What it's looking at is it's looking at the demographic characteristics of a state or a district. It's looking at particularly two factors of those demographics, the percent of non-white or white population inversely, and it's looking at the percent of college-educated population, because my theory at this time period now is accepted wisdom, but when I first debuted it back in 2017, it was a kind of a radical idea that we were going to see this explosion in realignment of college-educated voters, not just from, you know, current college-educated adults changing, although there is some of that. Those are mostly independents moving, you know, more to the left. The big realignment for college education actually is coming from generational replacement. Gen Z and millennial college-educated whites are not aligning to the Republicans, they're aligning to the Democrats. It's no longer cool to be Alex P. Keaton. In fact, it's not cool to be a Republican for many of the under 40 crowd. And so when we look at what's happening in the suburbs, some of the analysis kind of stuck in this like perception of the suburbs as distinctly white and, you know, populated by baby boomers and maybe Gen X. But now your average homeowner in those suburbs might be a millennial. And millennials are hitting 40. They're going bald. They've made the terrible mistake I've made of having children, right? And, you know, they're finally coming into their age of voting, because even though people legally become eligible to vote at 18, generally speaking, they don't really get into voting until they get into deeper into adulthood. So, you know, really talking about these three factors.
Such that the model more firmly defines the electorate in terms of the partisanship, that puts the focus obviously on the swing. But your primary contention is that that swing voter group is much smaller than others might have believed in the past. So that puts a lot of emphasis obviously on predicting how they'll be voting in the next election. But there's a term that you used in your last report that I wasn't clear to me. You spoke about protest balloting, and that a protest balloting in 2016 was 3 to 5 times higher than normal in the swing states. Could you say a little bit more about that and what protest balloting means and how it might impact this next election?
Yeah, sure, because it's actually the one weak spot of my forecast. It's the Achilles heel. It's the one, you know, you have this big coat of armor and there's almost nothing that could go wrong with it, but there's this one thing that could, right? And it's actually this protest balloting thing. I don't think it will. I talk about in my forecast negative partisanship being such that it is. That, you know, I kind of anticipated that Bernie would run a competitive race, but it wouldn't be as competitive as 2016 because the field would be fractured this time. He wouldn't have all of the, you know, vote to himself, basically, from that side of the party. And that the losers would not be as sore this time, and that ultimately with Trump being an actual threat and not a hypothetical one, we would see less defection. But third party defection is the act of casting a protest ballot. And what we saw in 2016 was extraordinarily high rates of that. And it went, you know, write-in ballots to, you know, you don't know who people wrote in. Most states do not record the write-in name because it's so arduous to do that. But one can assume a great number of write-ins were for Bernie Sanders. Green Party candidate Jill Stein got quite a few of ballots, but also
in states like Wisconsin.
Yes, critical.
So that was nearly 6% of the vote was protest ballot.
It was over 6. It was 6.32 in Wisconsin, in all of the swing states aside from Ohio and Iowa. Trump won the state with less than 1% of the vote, and he did not break 50%. And you know, a significant more than 3 or 4%, up to 6% in Wisconsin of the vote, way more than the margin, went to third party balloting. And the Johnson vote, I want to point out, not all of that would have gone to Trump, because there is a significant part of white males who voted for Johnson over the issue of pot that, you know, they weren't voting because they're libertarian.
Sure. So, at this point, libertarians haven't even identified a candidate yet. So how would you handicap protest balloting as it sits
now? I have some things that I'll be watching very closely through the general election. It's not things that I can anticipate beforehand. It's, you know, stuff that I have to wait and watch and see the data as it materializes. But certainly if I was to see signs of, and I do know the GOP is making the targeting of these people a big part of their campaign strategy. Because if you're Brad Parscale, if you're in charge of reelecting Trump, you've got a guy who didn't win with 50% of the vote the first time, who has never cleared 50% approval the whole time he's been president, basically. And you have to reelect the guy. You can't do it if it's a 50% threshold. You have to bring that winning margin back down. And the only way to do that is to basically recreate 2016 and get a lot of protest balloting. So they are going to target, really, really heavily target, disaffected Bernie Sanders voters on social media, YouTube, and try to play up the disaffection, dissatisfaction with Biden, you know, suspicion of the DNC, and try to get them to do it again. It's their only real viable pathway. But there will be very clear indicators in the data that will tip me off on that, and I will let you guys know.
Okay. Well, your report, Negative Partisanship in the 2020 Congressional Elections, is at the Niskanen website, but can you give us a brief summary? We have so many trades to cover. I want to make sure we save time for the back end, but can you give us a brief summary of the key takeaways from that report?
Yeah. So that one, it deals specifically with the Congress. So I'm looking at the House and the Senate, and I'm really looking at the House as not a situation where, will Republicans be gaining back a certain number of these 40 seats? Although they might gain a couple, like a random couple of seats, right? Because there were a couple that were random, Oklahoma 5, South Carolina 1, that, maybe better defended won't go back to the Democrats. But in general, I see Democrats still on offense in 2020 and Republicans still on defense. In fact, because Democrats don't campaign well, they're not great at electioneering, and they still haven't adjusted to polarization and to nationalized campaigning, they left a lot of seats on the table, especially in the state of Texas. So that report really highlights where Democrats could make potential seat gains. And in the Senate, I identify the pathway for the majority for Democrats, really looking at how likely it is that Colorado, Arizona, and Maine are to flip. And then Democrats need a fourth seat because they're going to probably lose the Alabama Senate seat. So I'm looking at which of the remaining seats are the most viable for that, and highlighting North Carolina is probably the most viable. But if Kris Kobach is the nominee in Kansas, that race becomes very, very viable too. And then, of course, the Montana Senate race is good for them too, potentially. And we've got the Georgia Senate race. I think that's going to be contingent on who the vice presidential pick is.
And we'll walk through those in our trade segment. But the top line is a pickup. You're projecting a pickup on Senate seats and a pickup on the House as well for the Democrats.
Yeah, and I would have to say, if you made me if I had me at knife point today, I would say the Democrats are very competitive to flip the Senate right now.
Yeah, and that's big news. So in the last week or so, if we, coming off of the pandemic and, some of the states emerging out of lockdown, but of course we have new events with the George Floyd atrocity and the subsequent protests, demonstrations, and riots in various different cities. How do you feel that may have impacted the work that you've done to date? And do you see any shifts as a result of that are evident?
Yeah, when everybody else was freaking out that this was going to benefit Trump because of Nixon and da-da-da-da-da, I was like, yeah, no, the electorate is not the 1968 electorate. I mean, not everybody else, but quite a few people were making those comparisons. Nixon was an outsider. He was able to say, the incumbent administration is mishandling this. Polarization has, really changed things, as I've discussed before, but white voters are much more racially liberal. You can see this in polling data. So I knew that this would not help Trump. It would only compound. I mean, people see him particularly as a cause of racial strife, not a solution for it. So, but these are all things like the pandemic. When I did my forecast update, Biden had effectively sewn up the nomination. And the pandemic was just, it was just obvious that it was very serious, that we were shutting society down, which is something that I would not have known was possible to do, a week before. Right. So I said,
and if I may add, you were forecasting a 70% turnout before the pandemic. So has that changed?
I mean, I think unless we get a second wave, we should still see pretty high turnout.
For the first time ever on the who will win the 2020 presidential election market, Biden has surged ahead. He's been behind Trump all along. And Biden is now up to 54 cents from always being sub 50 cents or sub 50% probability. So he just reached his high just this past week. Trading as high as 54% probability.
Well, I hope some people who are listening to this podcast bought when I back way back because that's one thing now, when Biden does win, people will point to the pandemic and the economic collapse, as the causal factor. But, trust me, he was always destined to win.
Well, we're going to turn an academic into a wagerer in our next segment. We're going to take a quick break. But when we're back, Rachel, we're going to walk through about 15 different markets for your take on where the probabilities lie from your model. So we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Political Trade, featuring election analyst Rachel Bitticoffer. We're going to be walking through the predicted markets for the first time, taking Rachel along on that walk, and she's going to be using her analysis and her model to identify mispriced opportunities that represent trades for prediction market traders. So she has given us a list of 15 markets that she has identified some opportunities, and we're going to walk through those right now. Rachel, are you ready?
Yep, I'm ready.
Let's do it. First market, what will be the Electoral College margin? So this is the EC market, Electoral College margin in the 2020 presidential election.
Yeah, right now I'm going high on that. You know, of the two options, I'm going with 60 through 99.
So you have a buy on 60 through 99. Let's do the pricing on them. Mike, the Dems, yes, at 60 to 99 is only 11 cents. Is that accurate?
As of this morning, that is.
So you can see basically the equivalent of a 10 to 1 payoff, a 9 to 1 payoff here. So 60 to 99, as this is a bracketed market forecasting the GOP or Democratic Electoral College margin. There's a total of 16 brackets, 8 brackets for the GOP, 8 for the Democrats. And currently the Dems 60 to 99 yes market is at 11 cents. 100 to 149 is at 10 cents. So there must be some big dispersion throughout those underlying markets, but that represents a high payout opportunity. When aggregating the general election market forecast for each state, predicted players are currently predicting a 100 electoral vote margin for the Dems based on the numbers we're looking at here. And keep in mind that in 2016, Trump had 306 votes to Clinton's 232, which was a 74-vote margin. And have you gotten more narrow than that, Rachel? Where do you think that number is likely to fall?
I think it's Florida, Florida, Florida. And I think that the old folks there aren't going to take too kindly when we remind them all fall along that they are the cure that's worse than the disease.
Well, we're going to be talking about Florida, I'm sure, as we move on. But so your pick for the Electoral College margin is the Dems 60 to 99 as a buy at 11 cents. That's a high outcome trade. Moving on to the next one. Which party will win Pennsylvania in the 2020 presidential election?
Oh, Biden's a Pennsylvania boy. I mean, I think it's pretty clear to me that it's going to be a Pennsylvania for the Democrats there.
Currently, the Democrats' yes is 66 cents. That's up about a penny on the day. So Republicans trading at about 37 cents. In 2016, Trump won the popular vote and the electoral vote in Pennsylvania. It was by a small margin, about 50,000 votes. Trump had 20 electoral votes to Clinton's 0. Is it Biden that's the differentiator this time?
I mean, yeah, no, not really. I think any Democrat would have carried Pennsylvania, and there's no, there's no margin there, right? There's no, what do you call it in football betting?
Spread.
Spread. There's no spread. So, but yeah, I mean, certainly thinks it's even better when it's Biden. Better with Biden.
All right. And as we're educating you to the profit opportunities on these underlying markets, which admittedly we said was new to you at the top of this episode. So keep that in mind, Rachel, at 66 cents, that would pay a dollar. That's a 50% return, which is less than 6 months. Annualized, that's about 100% return. So why are you an academic when you have all this knowledge?
Yeah, I did not know this thing existed. And now I really wish I didn't know this thing existed. I don't bet on things I love and care about. You know, it's like college football. You know, it's like a religion to me. So I try not to do that.
We'll have you back out in the fall for college football. But right now you're looking at 100% annualized return for a trade, a Democratic yes in Pennsylvania. I agree with you. That's really that's a great trade for a high certainty outcome. Next trade, what will be the net change in Senate seats by party? And again, this is a bracketed market. What will be the net change in Senate seats by party? The brackets are 12 total brackets. There's 4 GOP brackets, each one apart. There's a no change bracket, and then there's 7 Democratic brackets. So for example, B1, which is bracket number 1, would be the GOP winning 4 or more seats. The last bracket, B12, would be the Democrats winning 7 or more. And somewhere in the middle around B5 is a no change bracket. So the question to you is, what will be the net change in Senate seats by party? If you had to pick one number, what would that be?
Oh, that's interesting. When I looked at it, I saw two options. It was like D plus something and then lower and then D plus three. So I went with the D plus three.
The D plus three. So actually there's an opportunity there, as there are always in a bracketed market. If you had a high confidence around Democrats winning three Senate seats, to play it safe, you could take Democrats winning two, Democrats winning three, and Democrats winning four. Based on current pricing, Democrats winning three seats has an 18% probability, which means that trade is 18 cents.
Really?
Right. So it pays about 5 to 1. So the two around it are another 16 cents each. So 16, 32 plus 18 for 50 cents for you could lock in two, three, and four. And have a 100% return, investing 50 cents and making a dollar.
You all should buy that. Do what he just said.
All right. So that's your recommendation is Democrats plus three. We're going to ask you to get a little bit more granular.
As you want to say, number one, like what's that thing they always put on the investment ads on TV? You know, blah, blah, blah. Do not guarantee returns. Pandemic, right? I'm just saying, like, this is based on the assumption of no second wave pandemic.
All right. So that's the Bitticoffer disclosure. You just heard it now, right? A disclaimer as well. Next market. Will Donald Trump win the popular vote in 2020?
Oh, hell no.
Hell no is a 77 cent or 77% probability bet right now. The yes was 23 cents. And again, these are large margins. So clearly, that's one of the primary takeaways from your report is what you expect to be an overwhelming electoral college victory. Trump, of course, lost a popular vote to Hillary Clinton.
Let's talk about scenarios like where you should start buying that stock is a big second wave hits China. It's mutated and it is affecting children. Buy all the Trump popular vote stuff you can because probably no one can vote, you know?
That's right.
That's the only scenario in which I can imagine, like a major disruption to the actual election, then maybe you could win the popular vote.
An interesting riff off of that last market is the next market we're going to discuss, which is, will Donald Trump lose any state that he won in 2016?
Yes.
That's a yes is yep. 85 cents is yes. So 85 cents means it's a high probability outcome right now at 85% probability, but it would still pay 15 cents on a 85 cent investment. So if we were to ask you, what would be the number one most likely state that he will end up losing that he won in 2016?
I'd probably put Michigan or Pennsylvania in that list.
Right, Michigan or Pennsylvania. So that, again, 85 cents, that's a yes for Donald Trump losing any state that he won in 2016. Moving on to the next market, which party will win Minnesota in the 2020 presidential election?
100%.
Another Democratic bet at 74 cents. Republicans are at 27 cents right now. Clinton won Minnesota in 2016 with 46% of the vote to Trump's 44.5%, basically. Or 40, let's say 45%. So it was close. It was about a point and a half differential with Clinton winning Minnesota. What do you consider the margin to be in Minnesota? Are you modeling down to that level?
Higher than 2016, that's for sure.
Higher than 2016.
Yeah. I mean, the Democratic turnout in 2016 was languished and no negative partisanship. And then there was defection, you know, that third party defection problem. So. They'll do better.
Okay, so moving on to the next market. Which party will control the House after the 2020 election?
The Democrats.
The Democrats, which trades at 80 cents. So that 80 cents or 80% probability picks up 20 cents. Republicans, of course, on the other side at 22 cents. Currently, the 116th Congress lineup includes 233 Democrats, 197 Republicans, and four vacancies and one Libertarian. So that to maintain control of the House is basically assuming that they don't lose 36 seats. There's practically no probability of that, I would think. Yet you still get paid 20 cents on an 80 cent investment in that particular market. So you're starting to get the hang of this now, Rachel?
I think it's fine.
Are you in the wrong business, you think? Or
No. I mean, I'll leave the betting to the bold and, you know, well-resourced because I'm still broke and I can't afford to lose money.
But I think more people should be following you. By the way, what's your Twitter handle?
Oh, it's at Rachel Bitticoffer. And yeah, you should definitely follow my Twitter. I'm active on there all day. Lots of great fun on my Twitter.
All right, we're going to take a quick break from Rachel and come right back with the Senate races and the pickup seats that she has projected for us to talk about. But remember, if you're not already trading on Predictit, you are in luck. You can take advantage of the trades shared by Rachel today by going to predictit.org/promo/TPT20. Sign up, deposit $20, and we'll match that first $20 that you deposited. That's predictit.org/promo/TPT20. Deposit 20 and you'll have 40 to trade with. It's that simple to sign up and trade along. We'll be right back.
Want a little more luck in your life? Get Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability, named the best new magazine of 2019. Luckbox is a must-read for side hustlers, gamblers, entrepreneurs, and active investors. Each issue features best bets from prediction market experts, as well as timely sports wagering, stocks, options, futures, and cryptocurrency trading ideas. You can buy Luckbox on newsstands, but with this special offer, listeners of The Political Trade can receive a 10-issue digital subscription absolutely free. Just visit getluckbox.com to receive the award-winning magazine right in your inbox. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox for free today. Learn more at getluckbox.com.
And we're back with Dr. Rachel Bitticoffer. We're going to be walking through the Senate races right now, particularly those where she thinks pickups by the Dems are most likely. We're going to start out in Kansas. It's an interesting state because there's a lot going on there with Kris Kobach. Can you tell us about that race, Rachel?
Yeah. So to me, Kansas all comes down to the nominee. If it's Kobach, I think this is a really attractive fourth seat option. Right now, for me, the Democrats have a pretty clear path to the first three, starting in Colorado, then Arizona, then Maine in that order. And then, you know, they're going to probably lose the Alabama Doug Jones seat. So that means they have to net four seats in the cycle to take a 50-seat vice presidential tie-breaking Senate majority and toss Senate leader Mitch McConnell down to the minority. So, you know, that fourth seat becomes the pivotal seat. And right now, North Carolina looks like the most attractive option. But if Kobach is the nominee in Kansas, it will be an extremely attractive race for Democrats.
Well, that's an interesting shakeup because in 88 years, Kansas has only sent one Democrat to the Senate in the last 88 years and only a total of three in the state's history. So this is an interesting race because of Kris Kobach. So tell us about Kris.
Kris is a beloved figure in Kansas Republican politics. I mean, not by political elites, but by Republican voters who keep nominating him for things that he can't win, right? He's kind of like Roy Moore insofar as that he's got, he's an extremist. He has issue positions that make him unpalatable to the general election. He doesn't have the child molestation problems, but he does have a public image problem that makes him just not an ideal nominee for the party and makes a race that would be a difficult reach suddenly viable. They're just now coming off the heels of seeing that gubernatorial race go to the Democrats that, you know, he lost. And so, you know, there's one of those situations where the Republican voters do one thing that the elites want them to do something else. That said, it's not clear that he's going to be the nominee. I think your betting market right now has him priced, competitive, but not favored to win.
He's priced at 30 cents right now, which is...
That's competitive. I mean, I think they're definitely nervous. I mean, from what I understand, boots on the ground wise from sources in Kansas politics, you know, they're by no means sure that they're going to be able to disrupt this guy.
Even in national politics as well, a number of prominent Republicans, particularly Mitch McConnell, had hoped that Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, was going to run for that position, at least for the retiring four-term senator, which was Pat Roberts.
Of course, Pompeo decided not to run because he got busted holding those fundraisers with State Department funds.
So with Kris Kobach now in the race, and the primary comes up, I believe, in August, right?
Correct. Correct.
Which party then wins the U.S. Senate race in Kansas in 2020? You're saying it's up to whether or not Kobach's running.
Yeah, if Kobach's in there, Democrats have a great chance to win it. You know, if you're asking me, should I buy or sell Democratic win here? You know, I mean, based on the commitment of the market, of this particular market and the investment and what it, you know, the way this works, I mean, I would buy because it's a good buy, I think.
It's a tough state. In 2016, Trump won Kansas with 56% of the vote to Clinton's 36% approximately.
But it ain't 2016 anymore.
Okay. Well, we're going to move on to Maine then. Maine in 2020.
That I feel pretty good about buying, you know, Democrats winning that.
Okay. Well, of course, presumptive GOP nominee incumbent Susan Collins. In 2016, Clinton won Maine with 48% of the vote to Trump's 44.8%. Gary Johnson, 5% in that state, as we discussed earlier. And this is a state so well suited to protest balloting or a third party, but we really haven't seen that candidate emerge, as we said earlier.
Yeah, Collins is in trouble this time. Her reputation up there has always been this modern maverick, and she's always gotten away with it because the Democrats are incompetent at nationalizing races and tying her to, you know, the Republican brand. But, you know, what's changed the variable in 2020 is, like, the Democrats may or may not get the messaging right in that race, but it doesn't matter because the Lincoln Project will, and Collins is going to get tied to Trump, right? And I just don't think that the recipe for victory in Colorado and Arizona, which we'll get to, is a different recipe than what has to happen in Maine. Maine is one of those rare states where you have a ton of independent voters. The Northeast is a political outlier. That's where all of the political independents that serve in the Senate come from. And Maine is one of those states, right? The other senator from Maine, Angus King, is an independent. So she, you know, her pathway to re-election or demise is a story of independent preferences, keeping in mind independent leaners and turnout surge and decline is really important there. And I just see a lot of left-leaning independents being motivated to show up and vote her out, given what has happened with the impeachment stuff and the witness. I mean, she voted for the witnesses, but the impeachment vote and the Brett Kavanaugh vote.
So Maine, Democrats at 66 cents. Moving on to Arizona. Which party will win the U.S. Senate special election in Arizona in 2020? The Republican nominee has not been determined yet, but that's against Democrat Mark Kelly. The GOP incumbent, of course, is Martha McSally. And in 2016, Trump won Arizona with 48% of the vote to Clinton's 44.5%. The Democrats are at 80% probability right now, 80 cents, trading up a couple points on the day. So which party will win the U.S. Senate special election in Arizona?
It will be definitely Mark Kelly. And Arizona may, at the end of the, you know, November 4th, may wake up to find itself with two Democratic senators and Democratic in the Electoral College.
Oh, that would be a big swing in Arizona as well.
And I also will tell you where Texas is headed in the future.
In the future. Right. So let's move on to Colorado, which is a state I know you've had a lot of opinion on with respect to GOP incumbent Cory Gardner. You said in your report, if Virginia had a realignment cousin, it'd be the state of Colorado. And that is very bad news for the state's incumbent Republican senator, Cory Gardner. I consider Cory Gardner to be the Barbara Comstock of the 2020 cycle. So in that market, which party will win the U.S. Senate election in Colorado in 2020? Democrats are currently trading at 87 cents, 87% probability.
It should be just a dollar, you know? Yeah, I mean, you know, it's the same story with Comstock too. So, I mean, that's the way it works, right? All, you know, the people who pay the price are the candidates that live in and work in the swing districts in the swing states. So Comstock was, you know, very temperamentally and ideologically moderate. And, you know, that didn't save her because she lost by 10 points, right? So Gardner is, you know, there's not much he can do. There's nothing he can do. I mean, if he had come to me and said, hey, Rachel, can I win the race? And I am honest with people. I think a lot of consultants have financial reasons not to be honest with people. I'm not a consultant, but so I could tell them the truth and I'd say, no, you absolutely cannot win this race, right? So, you know, that's Gardner.
So that's the Democratic Senate seat in Colorado in 2020.
Yeah, nothing, like no one is the bigger loser from Donald Trump, like politically, than Cory Gardner in the Senate.
He's very vulnerable in Colorado, to say the least. And that brings us to the market that has the most volume and the most attention, of course, right now, because of its timeliness, and that's the Veep Stakes market, with Joe Biden selecting his vice presidential nominee. Who will win the 2020 Democratic vice presidential nomination? And, of course, when we look at this market right now, let's give you a lay of the land. The front runner has been Kamala Harris, has been for quite some time. She's been leading for at least the last 90 days.
That really surprises me. I'm surprised until the last week, I'm surprised that Amy Klobuchar was not the front runner on this market.
She was in second for a long time. And when the George Floyd incident broke and...
After that, yeah. But like, I'm just shocked because... Like she, until this Floyd, if it wasn't for this connection to Floyd, the cop and Floyd, like she would be, I know how like the Democratic consultant world thinks, like you would think Klobuchar would be the pick.
So she was trading in the high 20 cents. So let's back up a little bit. We can talk about the picks in a moment, but you have a general philosophy around the Biden's, VP pick that you've been espousing. So why don't you say a little bit about that?
Ultimately, when I'm looking at the VP pick, number one, I'm arguing VP picks now matter. They didn't before, but now they do. And or at least they should be used strategically the way that Trump used the Pence pick to assuage fears among evangelical Christians that he was going to be a fake, that he wasn't going to follow through on conservative promises. And so I argue you need to pick a vice presidential pick to deal with the factionalism within your own party, because in today's environment, both parties have this inter-party factionalism issue. And so you need to deal with the ideological factionalism. And then in the case of the Democrats, and this is not a problem Republicans have, obviously, but in the case of the Democrats, you have diversity issues, right? The last two nominees have ended up being old white people. This is a party that is increasingly relying on under 40 voters, the two most diverse generations in the country's history. This party is the most diverse party in the country's history. And yet its standard bearers you don't want to send two white people as the standard bearers. So I argued in my New York Times op-ed on Tuesday, this is before the Floyd thing, it was just developing, how important it was for him to nominate a female person of color, and that person not be a moderate, right? And I think the case for that in the week since that published has really made itself clear. Obviously, Black citizens of this country have really, really made the statement of how hungry they are for representation and to get their issues on the agenda. So I think that, we really are looking now at Biden must be thinking very clearly about a Black female running mate.
And of course, that was reflected immediately in the prediction markets, whereas Klobuchar was running in second in the low 20s for several months. She's immediately fallen into mid-single digits. And Val Demings has emerged as the second candidate right now. But before we get into the underlying names, I did notice, having followed you very closely since I first caught you on Bill Maher, that you were quite the advocate of Stacey Abrams. It appears as though you've backed off that name as being a probable pick in recent weeks. Is that fair to say?
Oh, no, you asked me who I thought would be probably picked, so I gave you that. But like, if you ask me who I think he should pick, then Stacey Abrams would be on that list.
Yeah. I see.
Yeah, Yeah.
But you would agree that that's not a high probability outcome at this
point? No. I don't. I mean, I have no reason to think that that is. I think it's a mistake. I think that, you know, the only thing that if I'm running campaign, the only thing I care about is winning. I don't give a shit about, you know, anything else. All the other things that people are looking at are post winning. And the only thing I care about is winning. I've got this massive boring problem because I'm Biden. You know, there's no enthusiasm for him. There's enthusiasm for the environment, the atmosphere, but not for him. And that enthusiasm deficit is within that under 40 group. And there's just not that many people that could deal with that deficit. Sanders is out for me because he's a socialist. So you don't want him. He's the obvious pick. You could go with a Hollywood celeb, but then if you're going to be doing like an experience deficit anyway, you might as well go with Stacey Abrams.
But you did identify then three picks in order, and let's walk through them. At the top of the list is also at the top of the charts right now. It's Kamala Harris. She's at 38 cents. She's been the front runner for a long time. Let's talk through the pros and cons. Why do you believe that she's the most likely pick, and do you feel she's the best pick right now?
Harris is definitely the number one now. But, you know, again, I have no idea what's back in that prosecutor background. She's obviously a female African-American, so that helps. But just, this is a problem for number two, too, Demings. She was a chief of police in Orlando. If either of them have any conflicts with prosecution or overseeing issues that would, be a problem on race, I just don't see how you can nominate them. So, like, to me, like, if I was Biden, like, that, I'd be vetting that extensively.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. Of course, just to back up, Harris has been very close to James Clyburn of South Carolina. In fact, they're working together right now on another coronavirus-related bill. So she has a strong relationship with him. And of course, Clyburn is really the person who gets the most probably credit for Joe Biden being the nominee at this point, or the presumptive nominee. To your point, Harris, she's vulnerable in a number of areas. She fought for the criminalization of marijuana as state prosecutor and then pulled a 180 on those issues afterwards. She has a name that's very searchable. The name is George Gage. There is a story that's going to dog her, and that is that it's basically suggested that she's fought tooth and nail to uphold wrongful convictions that have been secured through misconduct that included evidence tampering and false testimony and the suppression of crucial information by prosecutors. The names that come up where she's most vulnerable include Johnny Baca, Kevin Cooper, George Gage, among all the cases, and Daniel Larson. So there's some issues that she has. Also, in 2015, she opposed a bill requiring her office to investigate shootings involving officers. She refused to support statewide standards for regulating the use of body cameras.
Why would you do that, you know? Like, if you're Biden, why do that? And Demings, I'm sure it's the same story. I'm sure there's a litany of this, and that.
Yes. So let's move on to Demings. So here's the backstory on Demings. And Demings is interesting as a pick. Quite frankly, in disclosure, I have her. She's trading at 19 cents right now, and my average is from 5 cents. So I'm up 14 cents on that. But she's down quite a bit on the day. She was as high as 23 cents yesterday, and she's down to 19. But she has some vulnerability as well. A 2015 Orlando Sentinel investigation showed that when she was, as you noted, chief of police at Orlando, that the use of force during arrest was more than double the rate of her predecessors. And an Atlantic story in 2015 also noted millions of dollars in lawsuit settlements for excessive force during her reign. So she has some vulnerability there, but I'll put this back to you. Considering first of all, California is a given. So naming Harris adds nothing to the ticket from that perspective, but Florida being such a critical swing state, Trump won Florida by 1.2%. African-Americans now make up 18% of that vote. You know, there's three states that really matter, right? Florida, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, 55 electoral votes right there. What would you say the probability of a Trump outcome or a Biden win is, assuming that Florida is blue?
Zero.
No, I'm sorry, a Biden victory if Florida goes blue.
A 100 in votes. Yeah.
So with that in mind.
Yeah, but I'm not certain in this moment that it's not absolute suicide to put any candidate on that vice presidential ticket that has a record of law enforcement leadership or law enforcement.
So noted. So that takes us then to Susan Rice, which was one
I mean,
of your...
don't get me wrong. I think that they would still win ultimately. And, it, you know, but if I was running the campaign, in which I'm not, you know, which is unfortunate for them. If I was, I would be looking at Susan Rice. If I'm really hung up on experience, which I'm not, I would be looking at Abrams, because all I give a shit about is turning out as many Black and young voters as humanly possible and avoiding progressive defection. If I can do those three things in this environment, I am not losing pure independence because unless I'm incompetent at messaging, right? I have that centrist part of the electorate sewed up. And now I really just want to make sure I dot my I's and cross my T's and make sure I have Obama 2008-2012 turnout on my end. And, you know, that's the best way to accomplish it. But the last thing I want to do is go with a female person of color running mate and have her be, you know,
a liability
because she's got this record of that Black Lives Matter finds offensive because she's, you know. So, like, I would go with Susan Rice, or I'd go with Abrams, or I would go somewhere else. But I would not be going with Harris or with Demings if they have law enforcement back. Or it just seems risky to me.
Okay, so if we asked you to put a dollar to work here, and you had to pick two or three names, what would be your most probable
names? So, I said that I am assuming that they are at least not going to nominate Klobuchar, given that she has failed to prosecute the exact cop involved in the George Floyd murder.
Yes,
that
right.
That seems like obvious to me.
So her no votes, by the way, you can buy a no at 93 cents and still make 7 cents
there. I'm
assuming
no on Klobuchar, you know. You know, I think Harris is still probably the front runner. And, you know, she could survive that stuff, maybe. I'm just thinking of risk mitigation. I want as much bang for the buck and with as little risk. And, you know, people really underestimate how advantageous it is to have, like, little bits of political baggage. So looking at somebody like Stacey Abrams, you know, who has very little political baggage, is very attractive. To me, but, you know.
Well, Rachel, this has been a lot of fun. First of all, Mike and I feel honored to be able to expose you to the prediction market. So maybe we've created a monster that remains to be seen. And it's really been great to hear your insights on some of these markets. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It was fun.
Of course. And thanks for tuning into The Political Trade. Be sure to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts and be the first to catch the insights shared by our guests. And check out thepoliticaltrade.com to subscribe to our newsletter. Find us on social media or send us a message. It's all there at thepoliticaltrade.com. Mike, anything else to add?
Yeah, we have one quick announcement. So you've listened to us, and now we want to hear from you. So in the show notes for this episode, we're including a link to our first ever listener survey. We're looking for comments, criticism, opinions, ideas, just anything for how we can make TPT better. So we'd love to hear your thoughts. The link to that survey will be in the show notes. So please consider taking our survey.
One thing for certain, if I had your voice, this show would be a lot better. Thanks for that tag. So this is Jeff Joseph. I'm signing off.
And I'm Mike Reddy.
Okay. And remember, still wash your hands, social distance, believe in math, and join us next time on The Political Trade.